It's January 7th, 2024, and welcome to episode 272 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and further adventures in trying to remember how to podcast. I am Paul Hegstrom, this time near Montreal, and I am joined by three retro computing enthusiasts, the first of whom is Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
I'm first, baby. Doing great. Happy another year.
Excellent. Thanks. And next we have Blake Patterson, DC area, he says.
DC area indeed, just outside. Yep, doing well. Weather is actually, it's been intensively cold, well, for this area. Although today it's taking a break, so I took a walk, and that was nice. So I'm all charged up and ready to go. And it's actually been a very, very retro, hands-on, fun kind of work holiday here last month, so... It's been good times in the retro area for me, so, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, it's snowing here. I thought, isn't the whole East Coast under a snow? I guess maybe
we canceled all kind of plans midweek last week. There was going to be this enormous snow here, crazy, crazy snow. We got enormous rain, so I didn't actually look in to see what happened up the coast, but D.C. was just wet, and so nope, not really. Yeah, so it's wetter up there near Monty Hall, apparently.
Right. Excellent. And joining us from rural British Columbia, Quinn Dungy.
Hello.
Okay, so I guess the topic, we are all very well prepared, as always. The topic has been generally following the episode numbers. So this is episode 272, and we will talk about things from 1972 that we happened to dig up. I think, right?
Indeed. Most obvious is the C language.
Yep. So there's that.
Big deal. Like it's no programming language I think has affected my life more than C. So C essentially got invented in 1972, and some version of it is how I've made some version of my living for a big chunk of my life. So it's huge. Like, oh my gosh. Programming, I was introduced to the concept through BASIC, but the first time I did a program that was anything fancy and was with C, and then Objective-C, like some version of this, is still, like my life is all about C. My name even starts with C. It's crazy. It's all C's, baby.
Yeah, there's so many, indeed, so many C-like languages. I mean, I am, for 20-some years, I've been a web developer, front-end, back-end. And yeah, like, even now I'm learning a new one. It's this language called Java. Have you ever heard of it? It's, it's a little bit C-like, but yeah, so we're shifting to a back-end.
It's like JavaScript, right?
Yeah, same as JavaScript, that's right. Yeah, so we're going to do, Java on the back-end, C-like, and then on the front-end, of course, it's JavaScript, and that's, C-like, and yeah. I actually have not done personally that much C. I had this, I think, some contractor summer right after college near NASA, we did some C programming, but myself, I haven't actually done a lot of direct C. But I know you did indeed, Carrington, right? You were doing directly using C for quite a while, right?
Yeah, for a long time. And then Objective-C and then Swift and like just all things that are C or C-like. It's a life in semicolons, baby. And arguments about how braces should be done.
Mm-hmm. And just frantically adding more asterisks to the beginning
just
of something until it works.
Four.
That's right.
Pointers to point headers, and just everything's pointer to a pointer at all. It's pointers all the way down.
Yeah. I I see for the people on YouTube, Paul is sharing a kind of a document development of C language, and I see mentioned is it's the grandparent BCPL, which is a language I've never encountered, but importantly in my history is the language that the Amiga operating system was written in back, you know, in the early 1980s. And so, yeah, that was prior to C. So a lot of history.
And probably if anybody who's programmed or coded, if you've done anything with C, we've all read and learned from the same book, the C mm-hmm. programming language, the KNR, the Cunningham Ritchie.
On the shelf.
Like that book, like, my gosh, right?
Yeah.
It's weird. It's weird to have such a like a strong association with a programming book. Mm-hmm. But like that's the one. If I think programming book, it's that thing. I spent so much time with that book.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, I spent a bit of time with C, but it always felt sort of like hobby level almost. So I took a class in college that was it was on parallel programming, and so that was in actual like C. No, nothing, just C. At this point, I don't actually know what the hardware was. You know, it was just a couple little parallel processors, and they were, you know, each one was given the task of computing a pixel and a fractal, and, you know, it was pretty fun, but that was all written in C. And I did some Next programming, and I loved that. The Objective-C, you know, was just like, that was miraculous. and I guess I wrote a couple of things on... like early Macs, you know, I wrote a couple of games and things. And
sure. A lot of early Mac stuff I did was on Pascal, weirdly. Mm. But yeah, like C stuff. For me, I always liked the Next stuff. I loved the look of the computers, but I had no access to them. It was like the thing Steve Jobs is doing now, and it costs $800 million, and they're going for weird porting thing. Like, I really couldn't get my head around it. And then it's like, oh, he's back at Apple. Then when Objective-C became like the thing we were all programming in because of the iPhone, I was like, why does everything start with this other, what's with this NS everywhere?
Right.
It's because you Next Step people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a when I was programming on the Mac, I wrote a couple of like little demos and games. Oh yeah, actually, for my physics degree, I did a physics degree in college, and like what I was my sort of I don't know what you call it, but like the end of the degree project that I did was basically it was about chaotic dynamics. Was this math? Maybe this was math. I forget. No, it was physics, but. And it really what it actually was me learning how to program with like frame buffers and trying to get like Macs not to flicker and stuff like that. But that was all written in C. But what I was going to mention was that there was a book called, I don't remember what it was called, but it was by Dave Marks. There were a couple of C programming books that were, I think, maybe using Lightspeed C or something like that.
Yep.
Dave Marks is a co-author of other retro computing roundtabler Jack Nutting on some like iOS development stuff, I think. So weak connection to someone who isn't here.
it's interesting. The Objective-C. I've programmed in a lot of different languages. I actually had a strange difficulty with some of the messaging, getting my head around some of the nested messaging in Objective-C, but. Yeah, that's kind of a logical combination of C and Smalltalk in a way, sort of based on mm-hmm. Smalltalk. And I was talking recently. I have a friend, Steve Riggins, who's an old Mac guy. He was a Smalltalk person. Now I believe he still is working doing Squeak programming, which is sort of a whole Smalltalk, you know, evolved environment. It's hard. It's like Pokemon. I don't really understand exactly what it is, but there's a lot of small talk like programming in it. Have you guys heard of Squeak?
Sure.
Okay.
It comes up occasionally.
Yeah.
I don't know anything more about it than it comes up here.
But so yeah,
it's open source developing thing.
Interesting out of Xerox.
It was on this show one earlier episode when I realized live on air that the Alto was not just the stuff. Right, up high, that looks like the it was also the refrigerator size thing down below. I'm like, oh, is that? Oh, it's less impressive.
Yeah.
I had no idea there was all that other part of it that's never shown in any of the photos. So,
But 1972, that does seem quite early for the Alto. I don't know what. I'm not
the
sure
Alto,
about what
the Alto can't be 72.
Yeah.
No. Xerox PARC, that's such a weird thing. Like, I think of it as the, you know, everyone says, oh, they developed all this stuff and the Apple people went and ripped it off and whatever. But it's bizarre how much stuff got made there. And they were just like, is that a fancy new photocopier? Nah, give it away. Who cares? Xerox seemed to have no idea what they were making or any of the value of any of it.
No idea what to do with it. Yeah, yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, that's not a photocopier. Come on, you guys. It's not a photocopier.
Speaking of that, there's this computer hope site that we sometimes go to sort of like mine for knowledge in the year, like what happened in 1972. And, you know, so you go through here, like here's some stuff, 1972, and it says the compact disc was invented in the United States. And I thought, really?
That's really early.
Yeah, it's not true. It was 1982. It's just like on the wrong page here.
Oh, I see.
So, that's
because you can see though that maybe it would, like, things get invented way before I hear about them or the public uses them or whatever. So it wasn't inconceivable that in 1972 the idea of, but it might have, you know, held 100K or something. But
no, Philips in 1982. Okay. So we'll get back.
It
to
looks
that.
Like the Alto. The first version of the Alto was March of 73. Huh? So way earlier than I would have thought. But you know, it's the first version, so.
There was a couple of short things on the list that we're looking at from 1972. I think Okimate, the printer company, was formed, and I actually had great fun. My first color printers, Okimate 20, on both an Amiga and on the Atari ST. They were like 24-pin wax transfer printers, but it was. It was pretty cool back in the day. I mean, I had never to see color like that, you know, on your desk was
according to the chat, everybody has to drink again.
Yeah, I mentioned Amiga again. Everybody drinks when I mention Amiga. One other little item I was going to mention on the actually there's a little item and a big item. A little item on the list as well is Prime Computer. They made many computers, mm-hmm. and in college, the first year of my computer science classes, we were doing programming using Pascal actually as the language, which we'll talk about a little bit. We would dial in, you know, on to do, you know, Pascal, access it from, you know, remotely from our. I actually was using an Amiga at the time, it was an Amiga 2000.
No one's gonna make it to the end of the show.
So those are, I think. Oh, and then,
my RCR bingo card is just going to be Amiga mentions all the way down.
and I guess the biggest innovation, you know, of 1972 would be myself, having been born in 1972.
So, cool.
So yeah, there it is.
I was already like 45.
So. The only association I have with Prime Computer is these ads with like Tom Baker and.
Oh, I forgot about that. Oh, Tom Baker, my yeah. doctor.
Yeah. I at this point now. Don't remember what the plot is, but you know some aliens are going to attack. But he's got the Prime Computer that they want.
I had never seen these ads. I do love that in most of the representations of the logo, the I in Prime is a one, PR1ME.
Yeah.
But yeah, we have the little Prime Mini sitting right in the middle of. It was the most antiquated machine. It turned into the big Sun Lab, and but yeah, there was this Prime sitting in the middle of the room, and there it was. You dial into it.
Cool. Another thing, let's see, that occurred was Pong was released, and I think so.
Video games still never catch on.
Yeah. So I am not an expert in Atari history. But I guess Pong was sort of like what started it. They were Syzygy before.
Yeah, Syzygy first, and then changed the name to Atari, which I only found out like last year.
Mm.
I never knew that was the case. In the text adventure game I made last year, Dorm, Syzygy is like a magic word in it. Like I always thought that looks like a word that you would type in a text adventure and have a thing right. happen. And then Kay asked, did I put that in there? It's an Easter egg for him. Because it's an Atari thing. I'm like, I had no idea that word was Atari thing. I just thought it was a cool looking word.
But yeah, so I think we talked about Space War a time or two ago. And that was Syzygy. And then Pong was Atari.
Cool.
So, but anyway, you know, whatever. I feel like there must be more to say about Atari, and yet I'm not too well versed in it.
And they the name
it doesn't exist.
They also spawned what was it, Syzygy, and then they spawned what was it, Tengen? For legal reasons, they created another company that was. Do you remember that, or is this, it was some reason that they couldn't market something? I don't know if it was some anti-competition situation or. Yeah, so I didn't realize that they had a different name before, but the naming in Atari is kind of a weird situation.
Anything else 1972? Do we want to talk about the Magnavox Odyssey? We can mention it.
Oh, that was 72?
That was also 72, yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about who's first. Let's talk about first. Let's use the word first a lot.
Yeah. Okay. This is to generate engagement.
Yeah, exactly. Clickbait Carrington.
The Odyssey is actually kind of a cool thing because it gets credit as being the first like cartridge-based console. Or, well, yeah, that word first again, right? People say, oh, or Channel F, what Fairchild Channel F, RAR. Okay, shut up, nerds. But the point is that what's interesting about this machine is that it had interchangeable cartridge games, but there was nothing in the cartridges. So they weren't ROM chips like a modern cartridge would be. They actually just had little resistors in it, and they bridged traces on the connector. So all of the games were in the console, and the cartridges, quote-unquote cartridges, just bridged different pins to enable that game, which is...
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's...
That is really weird.
It's sort of shockingly devious. Yeah, I think all the games came with it. I don't remember if they actually sold the games separately, in which case that would be full evil, but...
Yeah, because you could have just had a Switch.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, and if you took it apart, took one of them apart, you'd see that how it worked, and then you could just figure out how to get to all the rest of them. But yeah, I don't know.
Also crappy for expansion. It's like these early games.
Yeah, exactly. No, yeah, it had like six games or something, and that was it. Yeah. But you know, it was this early, so we were figuring this stuff out. So it was kind of neat. I imagine at the time, the notion of mass producing a ROM chip just seemed bananas. Like that would be so expensive, right? Because ROM and RAM chips in those days were crazy expensive. So they probably would have had to charge $300 for a game if they did that. So it was probably just a way to solve that problem.
Very weird. I never heard of that before.
No, me neither.
I didn't realize that they lacked the... Yeah, that's interesting about the empty cartridges. There is, in D.C., at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History, it's an exhibit that's went up in I think it was like 2015, looking at the date. I went right after it opened, and it looked as if if not all of the exhibit is still there, even though it's in the section where they rotate. But it's basically, they have a Ralph Baer created the Magnavox Odyssey as a sort of solo engineer. Well, actually, I don't know. I think he did most of it on his own, but they recreated his workshop in the exhibit, just outside the exhibit. They have and you can see the Odyssey. I don't know how many of the circuit boards that are shown are, you know, prototype Odyssey items or what, but and some of the other inventions that he's been part of. It was interesting to see. I think a lot of these objects are from his actual, you know, from his home and his workspaces. There's a lot of other interesting things in the exhibit as well. I think at least I didn't go around the corner, but when it first opened, as Carrington was talking about earlier, the refrigerator sized Alto is there. And I think they had, the first mouse, the wooden, Doug Engelbart mouse. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's interesting if you're in DC, or if you ever come through the American History Museum visiting, take a look, worth a look.
So to answer your earlier question, Ralph Baer did basically design it entirely himself. So the original Odyssey was a commercialization of his game Tennis for Two, which was an oscilloscope game and is largely credited with being first, there's that word again, the first video game ever. People will argue about whether it was, you know, whatever that Space War game was that MIT had. But Tennis for Two, it was like Pong, but he used analog potentiometers on the controllers to create what he called English on the ball, which was really just it was influencing the load on the scan circuit of the CRT. So it was like an analog kind of fake physics. It's pretty clever. And that's why the original Odyssey controller has those weird little knobs on the sides, was because he needed those to play his Tennis for Two game. And then he figured out a couple other games to do with the same circuitry. And that was what all the cartridges were. Not to be confused with the Odyssey 2, which was basically a modern console design
with computer ROMs with keyboard. Yeah, check with a flat keyboard. I had a neighbor that had an Odyssey 2, and they had some pretty interesting games. It was a colorful.
Yeah, it was a good console by all accounts for the time. Yeah, but yeah, the Odyssey 1 was a very strange beast. For sure.
Yeah, I was glad. I'm fortunate to have had this weird neighbor that had the Odyssey 2, because I never encountered another one, and I played the games on them for hours, and so that was cool. But yeah, see in these photos I took, there is in fact the prototype, his actual prototype, called the Brown Box.
And it's a crazy, brilliant leap. Like, it's one thing to go and look at a Space Invaders thing and you know, video games exist, and then you imagine Pac-Man. Okay, great, brilliant, wonderful, new game. But to have them not exist at all, I mean, sitting there looking at an oscilloscope going, I think I'm going to invent a thing called video games and make one. Like, that is an insane leap.
Yeah, that leap from non-interactivity to interactivity. Like, that's a real quantum leap there, if you'll pardon the choice of words, that is not to be underestimated. Someone had to think to do that, and it's kind of amazing.
Crazy. Yeah, crazy. I saw the picture of the Alto earlier. I can't unsee the fridge.
It's the great lie.
The great lie of all the photos I saw. Look at that.
Yeah, it's like,
I really thought it was just that top bit.
It's the fridge of
keyboard
deception.
And like, where,
so many promo photos only showed that top bit. I was like, so impressed. I'm still impressed, but less.
Yeah, I mean, you could be forgiven for thinking, Alan Kay is going to come over there, crack it open, and pull a beer out. It does look like a dorm fridge. Yeah. And maybe a pizza oven at the top. If that's
exactly.
Too small.
Yeah,
being impressed again.
Yeah, that optical drive would fit a pizza, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, you had to put the drive in with one of those big wheels.
Yes, the big wooden platter.
It's the version of a caddy. It's actually, that's funny. But no, looking back at it's such a good exhibit. I do encourage anyone to, that has the chance.
There's no way it was actually that tidy. They have not actually captured anybody's actual workspace. Like, whatever.
No, I don't think so. But, good times. Anyway.
Good times.
They ripped you off.
In summary, good times.
Summary, my arm, my tattoo.
I would also like to point out that, Blake, your neighbor probably thought you were the weird one. And second point, no one is ever going to care about what any of my workspaces ever looked like. But I've made my peace with that.
Yep. Yeah, it was. I had the TI, so that was kind of weird, too. You're like, huh.
Well, yeah, you were the weird neighbor, because part of your TI was in his house, because you had all of the peripherals. You had to open the window.
You're right.
It's like, dude, can you unplug the modem? I need to park my car.
Down the lane. Yeah, that's crazy.
These are the jokes, people.
Yep. That's why that keeps coming back.
Yeah, it doesn't actually get any better than this story, folks.
No. Yeah, there's like 20 people that got that joke, and only 3 of them are listening.
Yep.
You think we'd be able to capture at least that market? You think we'd be able to get more than 1.5% of that market?
I would think so. Yeah.
Or 15%.
Next step, profit. If each of those people just gives us $6 million, we're going to be rich.
Yeah. It starts to really add up.
Yeah.
Maybe that's enough for 1972.
Yeah, 1972, the year of Blake.
Yep. And, now we can move on to items of interest in news.
Do we have any of those?
Well, Blake has one.
Blake has one. Excellent.
In the year
it's been
of
a
Blake.
Slow time, folks. It's been a holiday.
So, uplift us, Blake.
I will
uplift
you.
Blake, with your news of death.
Uplift you with some sad news, but it has an unusual timely tie-in with something I was working on in December. The pioneer of software engineering, Nicholas Wirth, who created the, most famously, I suppose, the Pascal programming language, which a lot of people, it was probably the first procedural programming language that a lot of people encountered, myself included, I had a high school class, I guess junior year. Of course, Basic, as Carrington said, you know, a lot of us did Basic, but never the flavors of Basic that sort of were, in my opinion, Pascal derived, which dispensed with line numbers and used, you know, procedures. Some of the other languages, Modula 2, which was rather popular, Oberon 2, let's see, Algol, PL360, Euler, and a few others. Interestingly, Pascal, the actual Pascal environment and Turbo Pascal, which is what I learned Pascal on, is still existing in a modern system called Delphi, which is multiple platform deployment, quick, rapid application development. It's sort of interesting. But so Pascal lives on in a way, but unfortunately, Nicholas Wirth does not. He on the first of this year, he died at age 89. And so, but yeah, I think he had quite an influence. You know, we were talking about C and its influence. I think Pascal, you know, there's a couple of Pascal-like languages in my experience. VBScript, which was what I used first in web development, which was part of ASP, Microsoft, before it went .NET. To my eye, VBScript, which is not the same as Visual Basic, is almost exactly Pascal. And so that was interesting and fun to work with because, you know, I enjoyed Pascal. But so he has passed on, and there are a lot of articles. We can link a couple that talk about his accolades. And, you know, he, I think programming methodologies, he had a lot of ideas and innovation in that area beyond just the creation and handing over of
complained about slowness of software. Worth's law, which you mentioned, he gets a law. Not a lot of people get a law. Mm-hmm. Worth's law, he has a law. So that's fun. Basically, the idea is software is getting slower faster than hardware is getting fast.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe that, honestly.
We're not, yeah, so Worth's law is like our software, we're putting more and more crud in, and it feels like things are getting quicker only because hardware is struggling to keep up, but hardware is not quite keeping up, and things are actually getting slower.
I believe that, honestly. Crud. Maybe it's, yeah, maybe we're just cranky old people, but yeah, I am willing to believe that.
Yeah,
most so evident in the set-top cable boxes.
Oh, gosh. Oh, the UI on those things was just like a 20-year step backwards. They're just astonishingly bad.
So the piece I mentioned that kind of ties back is I was early in December, I noticed it was in 2023 that the Turbo Pascal, which was a very popular, you know, and very inexpensive Pascal development platform. It was, in fact, the first IDE, fully integrated development environment, where, you know, instead of, you know, bringing up whatever text editor you use and then having a compiler application and then a linker, you know, that you'd execute, you know, on the command line to get something compiled. This was basically an editor, a nice programming text editor, compiler linker. It would all happen. You could basically just say run and it would, you know, compile link, output the executable to disk. And it would show you where it was able, I think, on some platforms. I know DOS it did. It would show you it could run the program and then escape back out to its editor. I had started with Turbo Pascal in high school using this. And I did a little blog post since it had turned 40 sort of to mark the moment. And I had an interesting little odd, perhaps, excursion with it in that I ended up in early college. I was using an Amiga. As I'd mentioned before, and an Amiga 2000, in fact. And so I wanted to use Turbo Pascal specifically because I really liked, you know, I had old code and I liked the environment. And it was easy to emulate a Mac on the Amiga. So I purchased the short-lived Macintosh version of Turbo Pascal. I think there was only, like, it was only updated, maybe never. It was released and then killed. But it worked well, and it did what I wanted for Pascal programming. When I was having trouble, the Prime I mentioned logging into, the line was often busy because I think it had like two lines going into it, modem lines. And so, yeah, so I could do homework on using Turbo Pascal on the on the Amiga. And of course, there are people that commented, you know, yes, there were Amiga Pascals as well, but again, they were, as far as I could see, they were more in the older version of the way things were done, where you had a separate compiler and text editor, and I kind of liked it all in one.
Life before Xcode was what you're saying.
Yeah,
so a bunch
like
of
that.
Stuff I used, and then I got Xcode, and I seemed to never change.
And looking through this, this is something I noticed some time back, but I mention it sort of in an ironic twist. In the first issue of Amiga World magazine, Borland, who creates Turbo Pascal, had this very enthusiastic ad about Turbo Pascal coming to the Amiga. Turbo Pascal become the de facto standard of Amiga graphics programming, blah blah blah, and that never happened. It never came out. It never came to life. But this was an ad that was placed probably in early autumn 1985, and yeah, I don't know how far that got internally, but I can guarantee that it never floated around in any version. So didn't happen. Had to use the emulator, but so that was. And then here, a few weeks later, unfortunately, the creator Pascal passed on. So, I've been thinking about Pascal lately.
I don't think I ever used Turbo Pascal. I think I probably did launch Turbo C a couple of times, but but mostly I wasn't on PCs. So
we used Turbo Pascal in our high school programming class. That was my first exposure to the language and first exposure to an IDE like that. And yeah, it was good language. We had Olivetti's in our high school computer lab that ran Turbo Pascal and CGA, and it was fun.
Yeah, my big Pascal association is with the Mac, early Mac and the Inside Macintosh things. And also, I always think of the Apple II stuff, because I could never understand, okay, Pascal's a language? No, it's also an operating system. I don't understand. I'm sticking with DOS.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Pascal on Apple II was weird. Yeah.
Like, how is it an operating system and a language? It's like, I don't get it.
Yeah, and it had...
My brain is too smooth.
It had the visible cursor, so like you could see it drawing text, so you always knew when something on the Apple was written in Pascal, because it did that weird modem-style text drawing. But on the PC stuff, though, I was always really jealous of the Borland IDE environment, because it was all done with the, extended graphics character set that PCs have. So it was all quite clean and really, really fast because it was all text. And so it was actually a really nice environment, plus multicolored, even on a CGA monitor, it would do a bunch of colors for the text mode. So it was actually super nice. And at the time, a lot better than anything that my Apple could do, but I wouldn't have admitted that in any court of law.
it's interesting. As the TI went hard on the Pascal thing, there was what you're talking about, the weird operating system. There's the UCSD P-code system, where basically, Pascal could be compiled into not so much binaries, but kind of a bytecode, and systems would run basically a virtual machine of sorts so Pascal was in that way portable. And TI had these ads for it, and, all with Bill Cosby. And, a lot of literature and I remember in order to run it, you had to buy a card to put in your, or a sidecar. If you were doing the side shuffle, you'd buy one of those things. But if you were like me and actually had the slot box, you would put a card in there, and it basically had the hardware to run this virtual machine. So you could load, I was looking at some of the old TI newsletters in user groups beyond those I was a member of, within the last couple of years. There was Pascal users groups with thousands of programs that were all interchangeable and could run on the TI that had this card, or I guess I never played with it, but it sounds like the Apple would also run this P-code system. And there are other systems that would do it. I mean, PC mainframes, and I guess if you kept it to 40 columns or something, you didn't go crazy with the text display, you could pass this stuff around. So that just, what a weird sort of thing. Yes, it's an operating system in a way, and it's a virtual machine, and it's hardware for that. It seems so strange to me. But yeah, that was a thing. And, I never played with that area of it. I never touched any of that.
just to be clear, so all Pascal runs on that pcode layer. If you're building an executable, you know, an exe file on your DOS PC or whatever, it comes out as an exe, but inside that is running a little machine just running pcode internally.
Like Turbo
internally.
Pascal or something like that?
Yeah, everything Pascal ships code that runs that pcode, yeah. It's a foundational to the language, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, even like on the Apple II, like Wizardry, if I'm not mistaken, was written partially in Pascal, so you can actually dig the P code out of Wizardry and run it somewhere else in principle.
But and I suppose you could actually be an expert in reading P code, you know, operations, but that just makes it completely opaque to me. You know, like I can read the 6502, I can read, you know, basic and text strings and stuff, but I mean, I don't want to have to go look up what a P code is.
Yeah, kind of a tokenization. It's somewhere between a tokenization and a compile, kind of like AppleSoft Basic's tokenized when it's stored, but it's not. It's more compiled than that, but not quite all the way compiled. It's a funny thing.
Well, they say if you use Pascal long enough, like in the Matrix, you just look at the P code and you can sort of see the shapes that are being rendered. Yeah.
I mean, we've sort of gone back to that model, interestingly. If you look at like modern LLVM compilers, you know, there's a lot of intermediate language layer stuff now in modern software as well. So a lot of that stuff.
WebASM.
A lot of that stuff's technically compiled on the fly. So we're kind of gone back to that a little bit, kind of going back to Worth's Law. It's like, well, we have all this free horsepower now. Let's do silly things like that. Let's just compile everything on the fly or whatever. So it does enable a few neat things, but I'm sure it's contributing to the overall sloth of software.
Okay, I had a quick thing. So my thing was just, this is a little bit old news, I suppose, as we're recording this, because I collected this a while ago, but Dave Dunfield has decided, kind of as a retirement project, to release all of his source code in some form or another. And so there's a page that has a bunch of this stuff on it. The thing that I'm not sure where it is here, but the thing I mostly know the name Dave Dunfield from is ImageDisk. So that was it's a format that's been used to, you know, archive a lot of you know, sort of PC type and CPM type floppies. So it's a program that you run it on a PC and it can read, you know, whatever your weird computer's floppy and store it in a format that can then be, you know, either turned back into a floppy or run in an emulator or whatever. But so it's kind of neat to have the source code available to that. And it looks like he's written a whole bunch of other stuff. It's in a part of the retro world that I'm not super familiar with. So I don't know all of these programs, but if you do know the name Dave Dunfield as the author of something that you were interested to know, like sort of how it was done, check this out. Here's image disk source, which I apparently have just now downloaded live on air. But so there you go. That was the short thing. Then I could do the other thing, I suppose, that I had found, and then we might maybe done with the news. But this is a Kickstarter. It's not. I think it's still going. Yeah, 22 days to go as we record, and it's for a replacement injection molded inner bezel for the Apple iMac G3. I mean, I just thought this was kind of a neat idea.
Is that needed? Is that a common failing part?
Yeah. So apparently, I think that basically these things, they talked about it a little bit on the Retro Maccast fairly recently, but what they were saying was basically these things at this point are like, you know, sort of, I don't know, old paper or whatever. Like you just sort of breathe at it, you know, too hard, and it just all cracks. And it makes your iMac, you know, so this is specifically for those iMacs that are sort of like, you know, the gumdrops or whatever. And it makes your iMac look terrible because, you know, you've got a translucent view
you're gonna
on
see
this
right through to that
junk.
Crack bit.
Yeah. So this is just a replacement part for that. And it's from Mac Effects, who have done a bunch of like sort of clear cases for the Apple II and the Mac and a mouse. I think they did a disk drive too. So, you know, they've got some experience with this, but anyway,
they got the chops.
Yeah. If you have an old iMac and it looks terrible, and I have a couple of them that look terrible for this reason, then this is it's a replacement part, that you can get. And it looks like there are around $150, if I'm seeing this right. or reading this right.
So long way to go on the Kickstarter because they're looking for like what $30,000 or something. Yeah, but that's a cool item, and I think that's a totally reasonable price. But I guess they got to do a huge number of them.
Yeah. So if you're interested, then I guess back it because they're where they they're not. I mean, they're somewhere near a third of the way that they're.
But not even just now. If you're ever interested in having one of these, that's a problem that's just going to continue to get worse.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I did not know the plastic on those iMacs was so short-lived. That's interesting.
Yeah. So I mean, if you have one shipped to you,
exactly.
You kind of expect not to have a nice looking thing. But.
Well, I've got my iMac G4, and it's beautiful. So there.
It's amazing to me that MacFX consistently has produced these products. If for people who may not know, injection molding things is exceptionally difficult. Like the startup costs on it are enormous because you have to have a CNC machined die, high pressure die that is huge for a part like that. It costs like tens of thousands of dollars to have a die like that made, probably $50,000+. And then they have to have find an injection molding factory that will do a short run for you, and you have to experiment with the temperatures and the pressures, and like it's a whole big thing to get set up to make one part like that. So the fact that MacFX has done like 10 different ones all short run, it's kind of amazing. They must have a system set up like with a friendly factory or something to do this. It's not easy.
All right. I think we made it through the existing items of interest and news, since we came in with very few. So now, I guess a word from our sponsor.
Oh, sir, we like this Super Pong by Atari.
I'm sold out. That's a demonstrator, but I've got lots of these.
Well, we want Super Pong by Atari.
Yes, but
Super Pong's four color games are more fun.
Well, how about this one?
Well, no, you see, we'll have more fun with Super Pong's four color games. There's Catch, Solitaire, Super Pong, and Pong. So we'll take this one.
Okay, sure. You won't change your mind?
No. Why?
Because I wanted it.
Super Pong. It's not just another video game. It's a real Atari.
Families who are content to let television do its thing often find themselves at its mercy for a choice of entertainment. While people who want television to do their thing entertain themselves with Odyssey. The electronic game of the future, and the family's best foul-weather friend. Odyssey can be attached to any brand television receiver with a screen size of 18 to 25 inches, either black and white or color. And an ordinary screwdriver is the only tool needed to attach this Odyssey antenna game switch to the antenna terminals on the back of the television set. Once the antenna game switch is attached, you can select the TV position for regular television viewing or the game position for playing your favorite Odyssey game. Odyssey is played through an unused VHF channel of your television set and operates on 6 common-sized C-cell batteries which come packed with the unit. And your Odyssey is ready to begin entertaining your family. Each Odyssey game uses one of these special game cards which plug into a slot at the front of the master control unit. To play Odyssey Tennis, you insert game card number 3 into the master unit. This activates 3 lights, 2 representing the players and 1 representing the ball. Press the special tennis game overlay into position on the television screen, and you're ready to begin an exciting, fast-paced tennis game. And when you want to razzle-dazzle your opponent into submission, a special English control, which fits inside the horizontal knob, will make that tennis ball do everything but stand up and talk. 12 different and exciting games come with your Odyssey, each following the same basic play procedures. Each Odyssey game comes complete with all equipment necessary for play, whether it's one of the 12 standard games or one of several optional games, which include a special shooting gallery, complete with gun and 4 target overlays. Odyssey can be many things to your family. Fun, excitement, entertainment, challenge, and education. Why not take one home with you today? It's available only from the Magnavox salesman in the store. Odyssey, the electronic game of the future that lets you do your own thing on television. And only from Magnavox.
And we're back. Today the host's retro computing gift idea is brought to us by Quinn. What did you find?
Yeah, so this came up somewhere in my feeds, and it's if you're into retro computer and video game art, as I'm sure many of us are, there's this fellow who goes by Square Painter, and he makes artwork by painting with a brush, individually painting pixels of images of sprites and scenes from mostly classic Nintendo games, but he's got a few other things as well. So mostly like 8-bit Nintendo, and there's some 16-bit stuff as well, and there's some stuff that people would recognize from computers as well, and he'll probably do custom work as well, I'm sure, if you sent him a PNG or something of a bitmap that you want to be a painting. So these are actual paintings, acrylic on canvas, that you can then frame and hang on your wall. And he does them by individually painting every single pixel. It's kind of amazing. I'll zoom in on this one.
He's using a brush, right? Paintbrush? Okay.
Yeah, he's using an actual paintbrush. You can see it if you look closely enough in some of the larger pieces. And they vary in size and price range. So you can all the way from like little 6-inch square ones all the way up to like, you know, large pieces that would hang on a wall in a large room. So.
He's got a skate or die skateboard deck.
Yeah.
It's super cool.
Yeah, he's got some other stuff as well beyond just paintings. Yeah, he's got a skate deck and some other stuff. And it's always changing. Every time you look, there's different stuff up there. You know, what's in the store currently is just the stuff he's done that's available for purchase, but he's always doing more. And as I say, I'm sure if you messaged him, he'd probably do something custom for you. So I absolutely love this. I'm planning to buy at least one, maybe two of these to decorate my new retro game room downstairs. And I think it's a fantastic kind of thing for that.
I'd love to see a real tight zoom on that. Painting square pixels with a brush sounds like perhaps the most maddeningly frustrating thing I can imagine being compelled to do.
Yeah.
But I guess he's doing it with some skill.
If you go to the link on your own computer and then zoom in, sure. You can see zoom in with your desktop zoom. You can see the brush strokes. Like the closer you get, you start to see the variations in the pixels. But he's not, like, as far as I can tell, using any kind of stencil or anything like that. He's literally just painting the squares by hand. And it's really quite amazing. And the prices, I mean, this kind of custom artwork is usually not for the light of wallet, but these are all shockingly reasonably priced for what they are. So well within the reach, I think, of most hobby retro enthusiasts.
Okay. That is very unique.
Yeah,
very cool.
Nice. Square Painter.
Huh. Yes.
Very cool.
All right. Well, I guess once we're done buying all our painted pixels, we can turn to eBay, and Blake has some prepare your drinks, everybody. Blake has some eBay auctions for us.
Okay, so this is something that sort of caught my attention because looking at it for a few moments, I realized my initial impression was incorrect. It's extremely rare.
In capitals.
Museum quality IBM 5561P. IBM 5561P with floppy and hard disk, model 40, Japan. And it's selling for $2,249. So it's, you know, probably is somewhat rare, maybe. But, and it turns out, I think it is. I thought, looking at it, that it was in the way it's worded, I thought, okay, is this a hard, is it external? The box is sort of, it's not exactly square. It's very mildly.
It's weirdly squat, though.
Yeah, it's mildly vertically rectangular, but it looks kind of like, I thought, is this an external storage a peripheral that has, you know, a floppy disk and a hard disk and, you know, power supply, and you just plug it in to your IBM. And I thought, okay, it looks kind of like something you'd plug into an RS-6000 or something. But on further inspection, what it is, it's a, this is a 286 PC that was only marketed in Japan, the 5561. There's the 5000 series of computers that was marketed only in Japan. And they came out over the years, but I believe these predated the PS2, but yet they have interesting, their industrial design I mean, it leans more towards the RS, you know, their IBM's RISC systems, but it's, you know, it's in the same ballpark as PS2, a little more rounded, a little less brutalist in its aesthetic. But yeah, it's a PC. And so looking into it, there's a whole line of systems that are all shaped basically like this, this kind of rounded, kind of a wide mini tower stature that you'd put on a desk. And it's related, and this is a machine that had caught my eye, I'm about to show, that had been, I'd seen a few pictures of it, like in the periphery of some article here and there. I think I saw Creative Computing had one, you know, going alongside a PC Junior article, and it's the IBM JX. And what this is, it's in fact the 5511, or IBM JX. So it's part of the same 5000 family. It was only marketed in Japan, I believe. But what it is, it's a really, really, to me, nice looking, nice industrial design. It's a, it came in both dark and light metal. It's kind of a pizza box about the shape of a PC Junior. And in fact, it is a PC Junior based system. It's basically a PC Junior, but more capable in that it has,
well, it would have to be.
Two 3.5-inch floppy disks. It looks like it has the cartridge ports as well. A better keyboard and some monitor from IBM I hadn't seen before. But this was this earlier member of the PC family, of the 5000 family, which came out in 1984, was the first IBM consumer, you know, x86 machine to feature a 3.5-inch disk drive. So their PC Junior-ish thing for Japan is where they did their first 3.5-inch drive, which is kind of interesting. But I had never seen this. It's an interesting-looking machine. I kind of like the look of back to the 5561. I kind of like the look of it. Yeah, I guess maybe this is something of an inspiration for what became the PS2 line, you know, as far as, you know, appearance, that kind of thing. But I'd never heard of this. I'd never seen anything like this before. It sounds like you hadn't, Carrington. Had Quinn, Paul, nope. Had you seen anything like this?
No, never.
Okay. Nope.
Looks like there was a 5561 G, H, J, K, M, and P. Never heard of any of these.
Yeah, if you dig in, I wasn't going to, you know, go into that here. But yes, I looked in there. I think this is the first, as you go from, you know, from back towards that PC Junior-ish machine, this, and keep incrementing upwards in power, this is the first one that picks up a 286, and I think there may have been a 386, but there isn't hundreds of, you know, items in this list, in this series. But yeah, so interesting looking, and if you're interested, it's selling out of New York. Delivery price varies, and again, it's buy it now, $22.50 basically. But yeah, that's something new for me. I hadn't seen that before.
I know when I saw, you know, the image at the front, it really kind of looked like, you know, what a generative AI might create when asked to make an IBM tower.
Possibly a Nanoraptor entry into the PC realm.
Yeah, well, luckily it doesn't have a partially formed mouth or hand coming out of the side, so it looks like it's not, in fact, an AI.
Yeah, chat's asking about length. Like, can you fit a full-length ISO card in it? I can't see. It's bigger than you'd think, like in the front, but I can't see any stats about it or how deep it is. So I have no idea what it takes card-wise. Not a lot about this thing online.
Are there pictures of the keyboard? I'm curious if they have like some sort of kanji symbols on the keyboard or something.
I didn't see, and it doesn't look like this necessarily comes with a keyboard. I see that there's a picture of the internal of a 5560, but that is more of a, that basically is exactly the IBM PC style, you know, unit. So I can't find internal pictures of one of the units that's this kind of tower arrangement. I'm afraid maybe it is quite rare.
It's true though. It doesn't look like there's much space for cards.
Oh, here I found an old auction with one that shows pictures from the side. I'll stick it in chat.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so here, there's a picture of it, the keyboard sitting on it.
That's a keyboard.
It does look like it's long enough to have a card.
It's much larger than I thought.
The space bar is the size of a shift key on that keyboard.
Yeah, that keyboard is something. That's like a parallel universe keyboard there.
Yeah, that's one of the craziest keyboards I've ever seen. And yeah, it's got kanji, right? Huh.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah.
Space bars are for chumps.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So for viewers at home, the space bar has been replaced with like a shift-sized key that's presumably the space, and then additional probably modifier keys on either side of it. So there's at least it's two, blank. Maybe four extra modifiers on this keyboard. And two rows of what look like function keys. This thing is a beast.
They must be loading the keys with the kanji characters with all this modifier. I'm sure there's like four or five characters.
Yeah, if you look
key.
At the keycaps, there's at least four symbols on most of those keys.
Worse than a Commodore 64.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah. Or a Spectrum.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah. So is this, I can't quite tell, is this for sale? Can we buy it?
Can't tell if it's a current auction or an old auction. Looks like it's from, I can't even tell from that date.
Just
no internal
maybe
stuff,
has 22
right?
hours left.
Just start clicking those green buttons. What could go wrong?
Yeah. It sounds good.
I may have just bought it.
Well, I think this translates to about $500, so it's not actually very expensive, though the shipping would be.
Buy it.
Cool. Neat. I've never heard of these ones before.
And it's interesting that they're made by IBM, so that must have been a Japanese market-only kind of model that they were manufacturing, as opposed to like the MSX machines, for example, where Japan had a lot of their own machines that were made by local companies to meet their specific needs for language and so on. But this is actually made by IBM for them, which is unusual. I think there was a Japanese Apple II as well. Like that. There's only a couple examples, I think, of U.S. companies making computers for the Japanese market.
It'd be interesting to know. I haven't come across it, but it sounds like IBM's situation in this period for consumers in Japan would make quite an interesting story, interesting book. I'd love to hear about it. There must have been a whole unit dedicated to this, and that has nothing to do with anything that we've seen.
I'd like to see a book on the Japanese computer market in general.
Well, in general,
it was a whole parallel universe of computers that most of us have probably never seen. We in North America, we talk about the British computer market that way in some ways. Like most of us have never seen an Amstrad or whatever, but Japan was 10 times even further removed. Yeah, I think most people outside of Japan have never seen these.
Mm-hmm. Maybe somebody out there knows of something that kind of covers the whole. It gives a good synopsis of the home computing era in Japan. If so, let us know. I'd love to. I'll read it.
For a while there, it was much more technically sophisticated because they pushed graphics performance much sooner than like U.S. brands did, because they needed to render the Japanese characters to a reasonable degree. So they were definitely ahead of the curve for a while there, and probably nobody knew in the 80s and 90s how far ahead they were.
Those PC-88s, with the high-res 640
by. Totally.
So, they're games like, if you can see the trend, you can see a taste of it. Like Dexter, the game for the 2GS, runs in 640 by 200, which was, oddly high resolution, but that's how they, with dithering, and that's how they did it over there, because they had the high-res.
Because it was a PC-88 port,
the PC-88
was a really amazing machine that most of us had no idea was out there when we were plunking away on our Platinum 2Es at the time.
Right.
Thinking we were pretty great.
I did think I was great.
So much higher resolution, it's great. In color.
I still think you're great, Carrington.
I still think I'm great.
All right, so we made it through one auction.
Yeah.
Woo-hoo!
I can be quick on the next.
No news, all auctions.
I can be quick on the next. I have another quick one. If we can.
Yeah. Is it about the Amiga? I'm ready to drink.
I think everybody should be prepared.
Is it only if I say Amiga? Or
Yes.
Okay. So, yes. In fact, this is an Amiga related item. So I had this before. I think I've probably done this item twice before, but I keep it, they come up like once.
Is it your listing?
It's not my listing.
Is that
it's
why?
Not my listing.
I'm going to keep bringing it up till it sells.
I want it. I would love to buy it, but so it's rare. So every time it comes up, I'll throw one in. I really want one. It's a ultra rare vintage Commodore Amiga 1060 sidecar PC emulator for the Amiga 1000. So what it is, and we've talked about this before, basically when the Amiga 1000 came out, Commodore released it's basically a PC case that sidles up against the Amiga and connects to its side port. This is about as TI-like as you can get.
I was going to say, is this because you were a TI guy? So when you moved to Amiga, you're like, yeah, oh, it, I miss my sidecars.
If you're a recovering TI user and you need to, you need to feel the kind of ease into getting something narrower, this is a good way to go. So it attaches to the side of the Amiga. It has three 8-bit ISA slots. You can put a 5 1/4-inch drive. And let's see. There is the Amiga controls. It drives it to a certain degree. You use the Amiga keyboard. You use the Amiga screen. And it's the Amiga mouse. And you can run simultaneously. You can move back and forth with the mouse over to your DOS session on the PC side. And then you have your Amiga monitor. You can have two monitors. And it'll put everything on your main display. But if you actually put a video card in the PC box, it'll actually, output to that. Aside from my mentioning this a few times, is this something anyone was aware of, back in the day?
Nope.
Yeah, I actually had a classmate in high school who had one of these. Yeah, he was one of those Amiga people that never shut up about his Amiga. And he would talk about...
Amiga's like CrossFit. To run marathons.
Yes, and he would talk about how... he had this PC sidecar thing that would allow him to run all PC software, thus ensuring that the Amiga would dominate for the rest of time.
First rule of Amiga Club is tell everybody
about
Amiga.
Exactly. Amiga, right?
Yeah.
So this
CrossFit hadn't been invented yet, so Amiga was the thing you told everybody about.
So this is like a more expensive way to just have to save a keyboard and mouse, because you could just have a PC sitting beside it.
Exactly. If you, instead of buying a cheap PC clone, you can go ahead and buy this expensive sidecar item and use it with some limitations as compared to that clone. But you're
going to tell Amiga people about KVMs.
I've seen some interesting, the picture, I'm showing a picture now of a guy who's got this set up and he has a Hercules or MDA graphics card and a monochrome monitor on it. So he's got the DOS tech screen going and, he's got the Amiga screen, CRT over on the left, side by side. I've seen people that have gotten VGA cards and accelerators and they're running not modern, but games that were very colorful and that you wouldn't picture running on this thing. Of course, obviously it's impractical to the extreme, but it is a cool expansion. And it also happens to be the first way that Commodore offered a hard drive for the Amiga, because they apparently sold a configuration with a hard disk on a card that you could buy altogether. And that hard disk is accessible through the Amiga. I'm sure it's limited in speed because of all the translation, but that was the little fun fact, is that's the first hard drive that was technically ever sold by Commodore for the Amiga. But anyway...
And to be fair to the form factor, this was pretty common at the time. Like, there was an Apple II cross-computer attachment for the Commodore 64 that was quite clearly a full Apple II Plus in a box that you put behind your Commodore and it plugged into the user port just to use the keyboard. Like, it had its own power supply. It had its own video. Like, it was just an Apple II Plus that I think used the same keyboard. So that wasn't... The levels of integration like you had on the GS with the PC Transporter, I think, was the exception, where it actually... reused everything except the floppy drive, because that wasn't physically possible, but everything else in the GS it actually reused, but that was, I think, less often the case.
I think Commodore got a little better as far as later, when the slotted Amigas came out, they created the bridge card, which was, like a PC on a card, and they actually had ISA slots in the Amiga 2000, Amiga 3000, but they weren't physically attached to the rest of the system. How you'd attach it is you'd put in this PC on a card, which had a Zorro slot extender that would go into the Amiga slot, and in line with it and back was the ISA slot, and it would go into that at the same time, bridging that floating bus in the Amiga 2000. So then you could start putting PC cards and running, running it as a PC all on the Amiga screen. But yeah, that was not a common thing.
Here, by the way, is the ad for that Apple II add-on for your Commodore, which is just a scary, frightening ad.
Yeah,
it's for this Mimic Spartan.
Yeah, yeah, and it's 50% larger than the Commodore 64, which is also funny. So it's quite clearly a full Apple II Plus in there.
Tagline should have been, "Mimes can't shut up about this great add-on for your Commodore 64."
Yeah, that is a disturbing-looking mime in the ad.
Mm. Yeah.
as opposed to those mimes that are just like not stirring.
The calming, peaceful mimes. Yes. Sadly, everyone there's a number of people out there that are now passed out on the floor. I guess, which is unfortunate.
And that last item was rough.
I do apologize. Yeah. Yeah. So, that's it for me.
Perhaps we should move on to the next auction before it becomes 2025. Carrington, you have the next one.
Oh, cool. Do I? Yeah, that's me. So I use this segment to try to sell Paul on something. This time, I couldn't see anything worth buying, and I picked an auction that nobody should actually buy. So sorry if somebody in the chat is your auction, but I'm going to recommend you don't buy it. But it's an object that I really like. So this is all the new stuff, and it mirrors what I have or had. I don't know if I still have my Apple IIe. I think I do them somewhere in my Apple IIe. And if you want to get an Apple IIe connected, or a slotted Apple rather, any of them, connected to a modern computer, there's more ways to do it now than there used to be. But my favorite way is the way that I did it, was with a RAMworks card and the VGA daughter board that goes on it. Now, this is the modern equivalent. So this is the Reactive Micros RAMworks 3. So it's not the original RAMworks 3. It's the current one. And from A to Heaven is this little thing here, which is the VGA daughter card. I have the original RAMworks with the RAMworks VGA daughter card. And presumably this works the same. And what I like about it is the thing that I use my Apple IIs for is just gaming, like 100% gaming. And this combo works incredibly well. And I could see no latency, nothing. Like, it worked just perfect, hooked up to any monitor I could throw at it. And it's very easy to convert VGA to something new, to pop it over to HDMI or whatever and hook it up to a TV or a modern monitor or whatever. So the combo is great. This little button here is the display switcher. So this, you can switch between, do you want it to be color or monochrome or green screen, or kind of like you can switch between a whole bunch of stuff. And it's just, it's really cool. It just goes in a slot, gives you both really fast RAM and also VGA output. The problem with this particular auction is the price is $229, and these things are currently available, and I just double checked and none of them are sold out, and you can buy the pair from Reactive Micro and A2 Heaven for less than $229. Like, the RAMworks card is, I think, $80, and less if you buy it as a kit, and the A2 Heaven VGA extender is $60 or $80 as well. So it's less expensive just to go buy these things, and so they're currently available. So I don't recommend this actual auction, but I do recommend this setup. It's fantastic. So if you do want, if you have a slotted Apple and you want it to connect to a modern monitor, this is still my favorite way. Love it.
Maybe it's
fantastic.
Priced high because this is in fact the RAMworks 4, as it would be.
Is it?
Well,
it says RAMworks
3. That's what the eBay title says. No, that's what it says there too, doesn't it?
Oh, RAMworks 4. What's a RAMworks 4?
I don't know. That's weird.
Maybe that's better than one. So maybe
I thought it was a botched title.
It's one better.
Maybe they just called it that. I don't know. The one I have is definitely a RAMworks 3. Like,
what
an
is
original
RAMworks
3. That's also not how you do 4 in... He just 35 isn't just like 35 slots.
Right. Well, that's how many years in prison you've been.
Works really, really, really well. So whether you get an original one, like I got the original things, but I've heard nothing but good stuff about these.
Did you have the original from like Applied Engineering? Like
the long card with all the chips? I got, which I also just got off eBay. Like, somebody was just selling quite a while ago an original RAMworks with the VGA daughter card. And I just bought that and threw to my Apple
TV. And they had a VGA card.
Yeah, they had the VGA little daughter card. Like, this is all new versions of vintage stuff.
Right. So weird. Okay, cool.
And it works amazing. Like, just completely seamless, worked amazing. So, and I just love it. Completely love it. So, same was the original RGB output.
Carrington is responding to the question in the chat that nobody knows.
The one I have is an original one. I don't have the A2 Heaven one.
Yeah, it had an RGB.
Well, the one I have isn't like white. It's not the A2 Heaven. I've got the AE branded
one.
And I swear it's regular VGA. It's not putting out like an odd RGB signal.
Yeah.
I didn't have to use a converter. I converted over to HDMI, but that's it. Anyway, don't buy this, it's too expensive, but do buy the things from the actual stores.
It would depend what you mean by RGB. Sorry, my pet peeve. RGB is not a video standard. There are...
Oh, I think I'm, when people say that, I'm assuming they mean 15 kilohertz.
Yeah, like the 15 kilohertz arcade video. Yeah, 15 kilohertz horizontal scan arcade video, which has three separate signals in it for R, G, and B. But there are analog and digital video standards that are like that. RGB as a video output doesn't actually mean anything. But anyway. Sorry, rant over.
Okay. Oh, good to know. All I know is I got the vintage ones, the AE stuff, and it just works. Plug into any VGA monitor, just worked. I plugged in a really cheap VGA to HDMI adapter, just worked perfectly. Love it. Okay. Best thing I ever bought for my slotted Apple TV.
I could believe that there was a 15 kilohertz arcade video version, because just before VGA came out, that was kind of the best video standard for like deep color on. So like the Amiga and the 2GS both used variations of it. Arcade games used it. So for a little while there, it was kind of almost becoming the de facto next video standard until VGA came along and ate everybody's lunch.
Maybe they had, a separate later module that had VGA, which would make sense.
So that's my auction pick. I'm not trying to sell Paul. I'm going to sell you two things next time.
Okay, that seems fair.
Get your wallet ready.
All right. Okay, I am next. I have... So there's a sticker that says Archives 1. And the title of it says Vintage Computer Label, Rare Tag, Sticker, New Old Stock. And I looked at this and I thought, like, what is this thing? It's a sticker. It says Archives 1. I kind of thought this is, somebody thought, I didn't even know why they would have thought this was a computer thing. You know, like, it's just like a sticker for a file folder in the back of a law office or something, right? But it does say in the description, it starts talking a little bit about this. Made by the, it turns out it's new old stock label stickers for an obscure CPM computer made by the Archives Inc. company. And you can get an Archives 2 sticker, or an Archives 3 sticker, or
if you want to do an upgrade,
a definite the Archives sticker. So first of all, it turns out these people do not know how to make your computer searchable on the web of the future. To call your computer Archives 2 is insane. I'd never heard of this, of course, before, but in 1980, Archives Inc., it's somehow related to John Deere, the tractor company.
Tractor computers.
But they made this, the Archive 1, it was a Z80 processor, came with 64K of RAM, and it was followed by the Archives 2 and the Archives 3. That's plural. Archives 2 and Archives 3. And I'd never heard of this, and, I didn't know what to make of it. Turns out there's actually a little documentary video on YouTube about these. So
see the sticker.
Yep, there is the
Archives 2
sticker.
It's smaller than I thought from the eBay auction. I thought it was a bigger thing.
Yeah. But so there's somebody who used to work there made a what looks like a sort of like, what do you call it, cable access documentary of interviewing some people who worked at the company Archives Inc. The person who's doing the interviewing also has some other religious videos on the channel if you are looking for things other than the documentary. It's very community access.
All old computer stuff becomes religious wars anyway, so totally reasonable.
You're not going to say anything about the beard?
I was going to say, that dude has an amazing beard. We need to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
That is fantastic.
Wow. Yeah.
But I thought it was interesting, first of all, just because I was, I looked at this and thought, well, okay, this is not even a thing. And then it turned out that there was this whole computer company that had three different, editions of their CPM computer that I'd never heard of, out of Iowa, co-founded by like the granddaughter of John Deere's, the John Deere company or founder or whatever. But
I can't look away from his beard.
Yeah, it's mesmerizing. Yeah.
It's that center
binding
part to get you, right?
Yeah, it's the shaping. Binding. It's just
it's shaping in the dark
crafted
bit.
Yep.
Chat's saying he's only got two subscribers. I may be the third. I'm just going to stick it on the background.
Yep.
Just settle down, drink every time I hear the word Amiga, and just stare at the beard and go to my happy place.
I'm looking here and I see that it was shortly after a merger between this company and another that they released the Sam Coupe, which was the follow-up to the
this is no all archive. Fake.
That's a joke. That's not for real.
You almost got me.
Honestly, yeah. How is it that after years of doing this, still, like on every other episode, we learn about some new computer that somehow none of us have ever heard of? Like,
yeah,
how does this keep happening? How many computers were there?
Because we don't know anything.
Yeah,
we shouldn't have a show.
Apparently, we think we know stuff, but then there's so much. There's how many computers are still out there that we don't know about?
Yeah,
that where I've never even heard of the brand. Right. Yeah, crazy.
Oh, and I found a little mention of the archives business computer and on
computer. archive.org. That's fun.
That's yes, exactly.
Were they S100? Is that what I saw? Sorry, were they S100 systems? Something.
I think it was. Yeah.
Okay.
I think it was Z80 S100.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, Z80 S100. Okay. Wow. Anyway. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Let's see. What else? I thought it was kind of interesting. I don't need to spend a lot of time on it, but it's a Apple III in its box. You know, so if you were looking for an Apple III. This is one that has, sort of as you would have bought it if you left it in the basement for, 30 years or something. But
which I probably would have.
But yeah, I mean, it's kind of neat. It's got all the foam in the box and the manuals. And the manual looks like it might still be shrink wrapped. Looks
they
very
probably just
clean.
Opened the box and took it out for these photos, which was not a good idea.
Yeah, I think so. This is. Oh, look at that.
Looks clean.
So
no
these
dust.
Cards, I didn't actually... Yeah. So I didn't actually look at this ahead of time. I just saw, Apple III in a box. But these two cards are actually relatively... Or at least they were fairly sought after. What they do is put an Apple II... It's an Apple II board. So it allows your Apple III to behave like a full-on Apple II Plus or, with both boards, an Apple IIe.
It's okay to call it an upgrade.
Yeah. Well, so the idea is that you could have a whole like 128K Apple IIe as well, as your Apple III. So these 3 plus 2 and the 3 plus 2e, I think, is the
and this
one.
Is third party. It looks like Titan.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Titan.
Why don't you just call it the 5?
Yeah. Right. But so fairly recently, Joe Strosnyder cloned it. So if you want one of these for your Apple III, you can now buy them without having to buy the original, very hard to find ones.
Wow, great job, Joe! That cannot have been easy to clone that thing.
Would it very accurately say you went whole hog and got the 2e, two boards 2e? Mm-hmm. Will it? I mean, is it a pretty close approximation of a 2e? Pretty compatible?
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I think it's pretty much just compatible. I mean, I'm not exactly sure how it. I don't know quite how it works, but there were some things about the architecture of the Apple III that made it not possible. Even though it's got a lot of the same, processor and architecture, it's not quite close enough to, full on run Apple II stuff. And so this provides, I think, some of the RAM, like the RAM for sure. You can't. It's hard to use the Apple III RAM. Apple III has a lot of RAM, but it's not laid out the same way as the Apple IIs. So this, I think the 2E board actually, I was going to say it has RAM on it, but I don't know if any of that looks like RAM. I'm looking at all the chips on it. So I don't know how it works, but I believe it is basically fully compatible. So yeah. So anyway, it's a nice set. If you were looking to like just get a nice Apple III, it's $2,500 your best offer. It's in Canada somewhere.
Ooh.
Middleton, Nova Scotia.
I'll walk over later.
That's barely in Canada, but sure.
All right. Snarky.
Gonna get some East Coast hate mail.
Don't at me, Maritimers. I know you have a long and storied history.
We get an email that comes in. I buy. Well, no, to port it to you.
My grandmother's from Cape Breton, so I'm allowed to make that joke.
Is that how that works?
Yeah, that's real Nova Scotia right there.
Oh, so this is from fake Nova Scotia that's not actually Canada.
I'm just saying that Cape Breton is the most Nova Scotia of Nova Scotia places. It's like... there's like two people right now that are super mad and no one else has any idea what I'm talking about.
That's how we like it. Yeah, so this is... I think we've talked various times of about this one. This seller's auctions, this sci-fi man.
Yes, we
definitely
have.
A collector seeming to be... downsizing, but so I guess I'll just mention this is another one. I don't know anything about it except that it's an Atari-made IBM compatible. So Atari PC3. Apparently they made IBM machines. So this is an ultra-rare Atari PC3 IBM compatible boots and computes.
So, boy, this guy has some interesting stuff. Holy cow. Like, if this is the stuff this is what he's selling, I'd like to know what he's got in his collection. Because this is everything he sells seems to be something wild and rare like this.
That's it's definitely nice looking, a curated collection.
Yeah, he's got good taste for sure.
Also, another couple things, a pair of things that he's got. A Macintosh PowerBook Duo 2300C.
Oh, and it's sitting on, the first picture, it's sitting on a Duo dock. Mm-hmm. Does this come with the dock?
It does not, but you can buy it.
Oh, because I'm going to see if so, then that's a very good price.
Yeah, so the dock is sold separately. This is also in its box.
Wow.
So
that's the Duo setup I had. I had that and the big dock at work, or rather at home, and then I had the little mini dock that clipped on the back.
Yeah.
For work and travel. I loved
that. That was a great setup.
Duo. Yeah.
Also featured on Seinfeld for quite a while.
But just even inserting it, like pressing a VCR in, like it just
it was motorized,
such a pleasant thing.
Wouldn't it motorize?
Yeah, it would grab it and chunk in and just, it weighs so much more than you'd think.
The dock? Oh, well, both things.
No, the Duo. Tiny little Duo. You pick it up as a modern thing, you're like, what the heck, man?
Yeah.
It's just made out of steel.
And the screen is actually pretty small.
The screen is small, but it was great. I loved it.
Yeah.
I could never go back to using one as like a daily driver, but I adored it.
Yeah, the reason I picked this was, I had only the micro docks that went on the back. I didn't have a Duo dock until, you know, modern days, but I really like this computer. And I may have told this story before, but I got it, you know, I was finishing up my advanced degree and I was going to like write a dissertation and I thought, all right, well, I'm going to get a little like laptop. I can go sit in the park, you know, and write.
For 20 minutes.
And you can't see on the screen because like once the sun's on it. But the cool thing was I had it, I got it, you know, I was delighted with how light it was. I was, you know, sort of like dump it in my little bag of papers and bring it into school with me. And within, I think it's probably a week, it fell off the corner of a table. And because I was just sort of so cavalier with this light little thing. And you know, like after that, the screen cracked badly. There was like, I could see sort of like one quarter of it. And I was very depressed.
They made
about
the iBook for you. those big rounded corners. That's right.
So I was very sad about this.
That hurts. Yeah.
And I went back to the, you know, like sheepishly looking at my feet as I walked to the computer store and said, hey, like, can you replace the screen? And they're like, well, you know, it's going to cost about $20 less to replace the screen than just to buy another one. And I'm like, all right, well, do it. And Apple replaced it for no reason I can think of because it was totally my fault. But they just said, nope, here's it's replaced. And so I had this great little portable thing that I could take to the park and write. And I never took it off my desk again. It just stayed there as if it was a desktop.
Nice.
Well, the Duo dock was a beginning of the evolution of what eventually turned into disk mode on PowerBooks, which was that I'd never had a Duo, but I did have the later MacBooks or PowerBooks that used had the disk mode, where you could sit down at your desktop Mac and just plug in a big giant cable into the back, and your desktop Mac would use the hard drive inside the laptop as its primary boot drive. And so it was like a Duo dock, but you did have a duplicate display keyboard and mouse and everything and a duplicate CPU and stuff inside your main Mac. But it meant you didn't have to have multiple copies of all your files and be constantly migrating data around and stuff. It sounds like a small thing, but it was honestly awesome to be able to use your laptop as the hard drive for your desktop. And that was the thing that they only dropped I think the iBook era was maybe when they finally dropped disk mode. It was secretly still there for quite a while because hardcore fans knew about it and everybody used it who knew about it. But anyway, it was a great thing. Irrelevant nowadays since everybody just uses laptops as desktops. But
right.
These Duo docks, though, I mean, this was mentioned already, but they are funny because they behave just like a VCR. You fold up your laptop and you put it in that slot in the front, and it sucks it in. It has a little motorized inject motor.
That's because there's like 6,800 pins in the back that it has to connect, so they can't trust you to do that by hand.
And it had those two spikes on the side, too, for lining up.
Like,
And also the dock, that dock has a slot where it's got like a video thing, so you get like better video power when you plug it into the dock. Like, it was a really cool thing. I loved it.
I can only imagine what the mean time between failure was on those docks, because the amount of connections that it was making in the back is terrifying.
Yeah, I have one that's, I have a little sort of like, you know, tower of computers on my desk, and this is you know, one member of it. I think it's at the bottom.
Because you're afraid it's going to drop and crack. And you're still terrified.
So I had it plugged in. I probably should not have done that, but it was just, you know, it was just sort of always plugged in. And then at a certain point, it started making a noise. Like, I wasn't even really using it. It was just sort of there on my desk. And I think it's like the fan was running or something like that, or I don't know. Anyway, so now I have to fix mine. Anyway, and you know, I don't use it for what it's good for. I mean, like, it's supposed to be there to connect to like external displays and stuff like that. But really, I just use it to play with the eject and inject, and you know, then I just use the computer as it is. Let's see. All right, what else? This is a disc box with an Apple logo on it.
That's a rare thing.
$55.90.
Is it real?
$4.95.
Because everybody puts stickers on them and calls it an Apple product.
Yeah, I can say mine had one too, but it wasn't from Apple. I stuck a sticker in the front.
I don't think I've ever seen a disc box without an Apple sticker on it that was owned
by an
Apple
person. Sold on eBay as Apple disc box because people think it was an actual Apple product.
Little gold, or brass badge. It looks like.
Yeah. So what's funny about this one is it is in fact an actual
Apple product. The first ever in history on eBay.
Oh, wow.
So look at that.
Here it is in the 1981 gift catalog.
Oh, look at that. Yeah.
Disc look at that. What was the price on that?
Let's see. Does it say? $22.
I mean, the auction, 1981. Actually. $22.
See if it's gone up.
It is $55.
It's not a great appreciation in value given the amount of time you had to hang on to it. So. Mm.
I can't believe
I didn't invest heavily in those.
I think it's actually depreciated in value if you do the inflation calculation on that.
I was keeping my bitcoins in it, though. How does that affect?
It just makes you an idiot. Don't at me, crypto nerds. Jeez.
So an official sticker. It's kind of as we were saying earlier in the chat. The most of these disc, I mean, I have two disc boxes to my left that have the, you know, Apple sticker that came with the computer.
I'd pay more for one without a peeling old Apple sticker placed slightly askew on the front.
I'm saying that basically that most of the Apple disc boxes are Apple branded, the way that I could go Apple brand my cat if I wanted to right now.
Right, or the way anything modern is Atari branded.
Right. Oh, yeah.
It's also like that. So this official Apple one, it's very clearly the same disc box that like 3M or everybody sold. Like, I had this exact disc box. It didn't have the brass Apple badge on it. So I guess they were just buying them from some company and putting their badge on it anyway. So it's just that Apple was putting the sticker on it instead of Joe in Iowa putting the sticker on it.
And it's a little bit more than a sticker. It's, you know, it's some sort of hard thing.
Yeah, it does look nice. It's like an enameled brass something.
Yeah.
But the box not designed by Johnny Ive, I guess.
Yeah no.
Yeah, I can't quite tell. I had one by Flip and File that was I think a lot like this.
I had that. But,
My favorite ones. Do you remember the ones that were rounded? Maybe that was it. They were rounded at the top and they had a proper key, and they came in like smoke red, different colors. They were sturdy. Does anyone remember those?
I do remember one with a key, because it's like not like you could pick up the box and walk away with it. It's really important to have a key lock and a 4 ounce piece of plastic.
Well, actually, I like the key lock. I had one of those too, because what it meant is you could carry it without the lid popping open and all your discs falling out.
That's okay.
Because the,
I guess it does make sense.
Because the lid covers the entire top of it. There's no real way to pick it up without the lid flipping open on you. So
nice.
Well, My main association with those is they are unstackable. You know, it's like, well, okay, great. Now,
frustrating.
Now I have, this has got to be at the top.
Yeah, frustrating because you couldn't stack them,
Okay, let's see. Was there, I had various other things, but I'll stick with the joke.
Always stick with the joke.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
This is an example of A-plus Disc magazine, the first issue. It says 1980s. I don't know. But anyway, this is like A-plus magazine. They did a sort of a disc edition that had some programs on it and articles and things. This one doesn't come with the disc, though. Yeah, so I was, the joke was basically, I guess this is just A.
A-plus disc, minus
no disc.
It's just A.
Disc magazine, no disc. Perfect. Great job, Internet. No notes.
Okay, let's see. So we can maybe turn now to the closing notes. Blake, you are alphabetically first.
Alphabetically first.
What closing notes have you?
Well, I will mention that I think as I briefly mentioned before the over the break, there was a lot of retro stuff that I've been doing. Every year I like to do, you know, I like Christmas demos, holiday demos on the computers. And so, you know, I'd post a little roundup. But there was a cool new Apple IIgs demo disc that came out. It was a music disc, and it had the Ninja Tracker player. It was good stuff. Fun. I did a little video with it and played with that. There was very recently we discovered there was a lost but recently found kind of a slideshow with animation that we got successfully saved on the Apple IIe. So I like playing with those. And actually, I guess the biggest time spent in retro endeavors was I have a 46 class, a 5x86 DOS PC that I built. It's a rebuild of one I had like 15 years prior, but I rebuilt it like 8 years ago. And I made it needlessly complex with a SCSI drive and SCSI controller because I thought I'd run Windows 95 and blah, 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 like I did before when it was my real computer, but that's just was ridiculous. So finally, I kept the drive and the disk, and that's all there, but I'm now booting off of, I just added a simple, you know, CF card adapter with the, you know, it fits in the backs, in the one of the back plates, so you can just pop in and out the CF card and go over and fill it up with stuff and pop it back in. So I'm actually able to do a lot more with that without having to, you know, FTP across the room with DOS-based MTCP tools. So that's been fun. I've been listening to mods on the Gravis Ultrasound, the sound card in there, and just having a lot of fun with new games, new demos, and so that was a nice. I did not anticipate that I'd be spending my time on 46 DOS, my happy holiday time, but I did, and it was great. So that's it for me.
Cool. Yeah, it is pretty nice that the CF card is basically just an IDE drive.
Yeah.
So like
exactly
you,
that
you can just plug it straight in.
Yeah, if you do SD, you know, like anything like that, you got to bridge it, and that's an extra piece. But if you can find, and of course, with these old DOS machines, like I went out and found, like on eBay, a new, unused, new inbox 512 meg, you know, card and bought it for compatibility because you just want to keep it small. Yeah, it's great. Just pop it out, load it up, put it back in. But it really made it sort of transformed the ease of using it.
Also great for if you're into fixing up old iPods. So the first couple generations of iPods that had physical spinning discs in them.
Yep.
Most of them are probably dead now, but you can pop them open and just literally one-to-one swap in a CF card where the hard drive is. I did that with an iPod mini, I think it was. And you have a solid state iPod with a cool vintage look and as much storage as you want. It's kind of a crazy, cool upcycling thing that you can do. Old iPods.
Yep.
Yeah, it's cool. I'm pretty sure I did that once with one iPod, but I don't think I expanded its size. I should have. That was dumb. You know, I think I just used like something that was 250 megabytes or something like that. I don't know, something.
What's cool about it is that the drives that they used in those iPods is the same physical size as a CF card. So it's literally a perfect swap. It's kind of amazing how easy it is.
I remember when it was Toshiba or SanDisk, they came out with, I think it was a Compact Flash had like type 1, type 2, type 3. Rarely did you encounter type 3. It was a little thicker. And I think they made one that had the hard disk in it. You know, it was basically just before the iPod came out, that disk was offered as a compact flash card if your device had that little hump.
That's right.
I remember that.
Yeah, that's right. And, if you needed more storage, for certain devices.
A little hump, it wouldn't be full width, but it just allowed for that clearance for a type 3. And,
it was for like cameras that used CF cards and stuff. If you needed more storage for that device, you were putting a hard drive in it. Yeah, that would be funny to put in an iPod, putting a hard drive back in it through inside a CF card.
It's just funny now because if you drop like, oh, an old 8 gig memory stick fell out of my pocket, should I bend over and pick it up? I don't know. Probably not worth it. I'll just, you know, do I really want that thing? Yeah. So it's just weird. Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah. I got at a conference a couple years ago, they gave out 1 gigabyte USB flash drives as keychains as swag.
What?
Which, like, can you imagine 1980 whatever, like a gigabyte, and they're just giving them away. They're just garbage. Sure. Most people didn't even want them. People were literally throwing them away like a stupid swag.
Yeah, I've done a lot of trade show things, and we always have a basket of things that are, I think, like 5 gig, and they're so cheap to buy. And whenever you have presentations or info, you just hand those to people who don't mind putting a random thing from a random person in the computer. I'm like, are you sure? Okay. Thanks for trusting me, but I would have not done that.
Well, nowadays we have the opposite problem. So I think with that iPod upgrade I was mentioning, I think there was a limit. I think it was 4 gigabytes. You have to use a CF card that's smaller than that, or the operating system on the iPod can't cope with it. And that's an increasing problem. A lot of these CF and USB devices that we have upper size limits, and you can't buy devices that small anymore.
Even on the recent CFFA 3000, the disk emulator, I was talking in the Slack. I, you know, I'm having trouble with my move to a different brand of USB stick, and it's glitchy. It's not working. And so, you know, part of my problem is it's too big. So I just went last night on eBay and I found oddly cheap. I bought 5 256 megabyte USB sticks for like $30, and I'm hoarding them, stick them in the drawer, because eventually, you know, those are the kinds of things you want to use with those emulators. And I'll say finally that we were talking about the Sun Lab and the Prime and everything in college when I was, you know, my CS degree. I remember that the volume that held all of the student information for the classes I was taking was a 1 gigabyte drive in the lab, and it was huge. I mean, it was you know, in the rack with the Suns. So
yeah, I remember the lab sharing a, you know, 20, I think it was a 20 megabyte drive, you know, among all of the PCs.
Yeah,
I remember the first 1 gigabyte drive we had at work, and bought it from like a partner. We were partnered with Prudential at the time, and bought their used one because they're upgrading. I'm like, sure, I'll take your used drive. It was so expensive, it was giant. And I was like, I can't believe that's 1,000 megabytes. Like, what? That nobody will ever need that much storage.
One thing that I'm kind of annoyed by is that there were these CF cards that would serve as like Wi-Fi base stations, so you could, you know. So
I remember those.
If you had a camera that used a CF card, you could offload things without actually having to walk the thing across the room, and it would be great for, you know, drive emulators. So there were these things. I'm losing the name. I can't quite remember what it was called, but there were, I think Toshiba made them, and they just don't sell them anymore. They don't make them anymore. Like the websites decay.
They were orange, right? Weren't they orange in color? I feel like I remember those things were orange. Maybe I'm wrong.
Not the ones I have. I bought a bunch.
I think the one I had was orange. Okay. Yeah. I think you're right, because I had one of those. I think I never got it working. The idea was I'd stick it in a computer and I'd be able to just like connect to it directly.
Yeah.
And I think the one I had was orange.
They also made SD versions of those. They may still make the SD version, because I have an SD.
Oh, it might be the SD version.
Thinking,
that's what I have.
Maybe that's
what
I was thinking. Yeah, SD.
Yeah, I have one of those. I think they called it the Air Card or something. And I have one of those because I had intended. Do you remember Toshiba Radio, or what was that guy's name? Nishida Radio, who used to make Apple II stuff. He had an SD card reader that went inside your Apple IIc, or could go inside the Apple IIc. It was installable inside or outside. And so I had the dream of using one of those Air cards in it, and it turned out not to work because the Wi-Fi won't go through the shielding inside the Apple II, which is sort of hilarious, which I suppose you could take the shielding out. But the other reason, though, it wasn't very functional is because it was extremely slow, like very, very – you don't get full Wi-Fi speed out of it. It was so slow as to be almost – like it was slower than a floppy disk. So honestly, it was just too annoying to use.
Poor one out for Nishida Radio, though. Boy, the stuff – I just sat there just making magic.
Yeah, that guy.
That would sell out immediately. I'm like, please, before I miss my opportunity.
Yeah,
like,
before A2 Heaven came along to save us all, he kept this entire hobby going in the Apple world for quite a while. Single-handedly, that guy was saving us all.
Yes. Crazy.
Yeah, cool. I still have a couple of his devices that I'm jealously guarding in case I need them someday.
Yep.
Yeah, I think it was the SD size ones that I was thinking of.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that I did at some point put it in a CF adapter. You know, so an SD to CF adapter that then went into like the CFFA 3000 or something. And it did work. Flash Air.
That's right. Yeah. Flash Thanks, Herb, in the comments. Flash Air is what it was called.
There you go.
Yeah. Anyway. Right. I guess we're now on to closing notes from Carrington.
Oh, do I have anything? Been doing very little retro stuff. Last year was a crap year for me. I'm only getting back into things. On my iMac G4, I'm in desk setup, so it's more convenient to use. And today I've been playing, what is my disc called? Full Throttle, which I've played forever. So Full Throttle, and it's just like delightful. So I spent much time playing that today. So that's the retro thing I've been playing. And then that game I made last year, the Text Adventure Dorm, I have a whole bunch of people who want copies with the feelies, like just a massive backlog of people. And so the problem is the shipping, because it includes a little card and a pin, it's going to ship as a package. It's a massive hassle. So I've been instead saying, you can have it totally for free if you'll take not those and get all the printed ones. And so I'm just got to, they can ship as an envelope now, just a letter. So it's super cheap. So I'm just, but I've got like 100 of those to send out. So that's this week I'm going to get, they're all in envelopes now. Just got to take them to the post office and say, stamp these suckers. So that's my retro. Oh, and I decorated.
Yep. Gesturing to the wall behind him.
For the radio listeners, so Carrington has done super graphics on his wall, which was that 70s thing where you have big arches of
colorful
stripes. Yeah, complementary colors, and it looks amazing. It really does. It's fantastic. And he's got a matching chair. Really, it's next level.
Yeah. So digging it.
You need a shag carpet.
I do. I keep looking for, but they're a pain to clean.
Yeah.
But it would help with this echo. But I don't know. I already have so much stuff. Mm-hmm. There's two chairs and a record player and a lamp behind me. And so something has. If I get a rug, something's got to go. My minimalist heart can't.
We're starting to worry about you becoming a hoarder. So yeah. Don't know.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. I don't technically need
the
two chairs.
Writing's on the wall.
People come over. They can stand. I don't want people to visit longer than they can stand.
Yeah. Don't do the shag carpet. The house I grew up in had shag carpet, and my primary memory is how much it smelled. Like you could just never really clean
you
it.
You can't really clean it.
Yeah. You could never.
I just like the look. But I can't.
Yeah, they're gross.
Yeah, so I'm rugless. I'm living in I think it's Quinn, somebody put it perfectly. It's a 1970s game show set.
Well, I said talk show set.
Oh, talk show. 1970s talk show set.
Someone in the comments said game show set, which I think is also on point. But
yes. Yeah. So I got my super graphics, my funky chairs, and I just love it.
To me, it's the entrance to a timeout arcade. That's what it
looks like. Oh, yeah, I can see that too. Yeah.
So. That's it. Happy boy.
I don't know if I have much to say on closing notes. I feel like I haven't actually... I mean, I've done a lot of editing. Not that the feed can tell. But pretty soon the feed is going to have a bunch of episodes. And those of you who are listening to this now on the feed, this makes no sense because all those prior episodes were already there. But anyway, my retro time has been kind of largely on that. But soon I will be going through my office and... That will be interesting.
Cool.
So, the notes I had, which were left over from last time, here says office reorg continues, still fatality free, which is good. I've condensed my two, you know, garage looking offices into one, which was quite a task. But
did you discover that you had stuff you didn't know you had?
A little bit. Mostly it's just not didn't know but had forgotten about, you know, like, oh, that's a cool thing, you know. There were a few kind of like mass-produced middle Macs that didn't quite make it because I just thought, you know, these were mass-produced and I don't think I'm not going to be able to find anyone who wants these, but I don't need eight of them.
Right. Oh, gosh, but, right.
So anyway, we'll see. Hopefully that project will yield interesting things to talk about in the future.
So. Very cool.
Quinn.
I've been pretty busy. So I've been plugging away at my retro space downstairs. So in this house, there was an unfinished basement, which I have now finished. And one of the rooms down there is going to be kind of a retro gaming room, which I was going to share a picture of on the stream, but apparently my system preferences are not set up right for StreamYard to do that. So anyway, I won't bother. But there is, yes, yeah, so I've got a desk down there with my Apple II Plus and my 2GS and my Commodore 64 sitting on it. I found a desk, IKEA sells a desk, the Schlurkenflügen, you know it. No, I think it's...
glad Jack's not here.
Yeah, it's Hemnes.
What'd you call me?
Hemnes? H-E-M-N-E-S, I think is the name of it. It turns out to be a really good retro desk if anybody is looking for one. So it will hold three retro computers fairly comfortably. It's tight with the floppy drives and everything, but it will hold them. And it's got hidden cable tracks and stuff all underneath it. So you can hide all the cables, which I love. I absolutely loathe seeing cables. So it's I'll send a picture out to the chat later.
Desk.
But it looks better in the pictures, I will say. So you know IKEA's system of flat pack and you put it together yourself. They flew too close to the sun on this one. Fair warning if you buy it. Putting this together took about 4 hours. The instructions are 45 pages long. Wow. You're actually building drawers and cabinet doors, and it's a little ambitious for their assembly system that they have, but it is all solid wood. But because it's designed to be assembled yourself, the tolerances on everything are really loose, because it has to be in order for it to be assemblable. So like the there's a quarter inch gap all the way around the door and but it's reasonably decent quality. It's all solid wood and metal drawer pulls and so on. Cool. It was a real project to put it together. So fair warning on that. But it seems like a good retro desk. In addition to hiding all the cables, it's got a cabinet on one side, drawers on the other, so you can hide your floppy disks and your manuals and stuff.
Nice.
So you can keep a clean look, which is difficult with retro stuff, especially the Commodore and the 2GS. Those are both things that are difficult to make look tidy because they have a lot of external peripherals and a lot of cables. I mean, the Commodore, everything has four cables or three cables that come out of it because everything's got its own power supply and its own serial cable and whatever. The 2GS has a similar issue where it's just got most of the major peripherals are all external, so you have a lot of cables.
And a lot of old things have big power bricks rather than and so it becomes a pain to try to mount those under a desk or whatever.
Exactly. And the 2GS has this problem where all the cables are thick because you've got like a big SCSI cable for your hard drive, and then the disk drive cables, you have four floppy drives, all of which have these like 3/4 inch thick cables that barely even bend, so it's really hard to hide them. That kind of stuff is plaguing me, but I'm probably going to eliminate all the floppy and hard drives at some point. I've got them all set up right now, but I'm just going to go with all solid state, which will eliminate a lot of cables and get me a lot of space back. Sure. And on that note, I'm looking for recommendations from the Commodore folks. For once, please do at me. I don't know what a good solid state solution is for the Commodore. I don't know anything about that world.
Sure.
So if someone can recommend one, please. And also a source of distributed backups. I don't know where people get Commodore disk images either. Is there a Commodore Asimov or archive?
Oh, yeah. It's funny if you're outside of that world, right? Like, I know all that stuff for the Apple II, but I'm like, I have no idea where to do it for Tandy.
Exactly. I have no idea where to even go. I guess I could Google Commodore disk images, but I'm probably going to end up on some sketchy site.
Well, Commodore.
Well, yeah, they're all sort of sketchy, but... and also, I mean, honestly, the Commodore world, like, with all due respect, is just enormous. It's so much bigger than the Apple world that it's hard to get your head around. There's so many forums, so many communities, so many archives of stuff that I don't even know where to begin. So if there's some equivalent to, like, Total Replay on the Apple II, we have Total Replay, which is basically, like, every game that anyone cares about in one disk image that you can just download and it just works. If there's some equivalent to that on the Commodore, I absolutely want to know about it because that's what I want. I just want to be able to play like the top 200 best Commodore games or whatever.
Right.
I don't really care about much else. So, but anyway, so that's on the that's been accomplished. So the other thing is over the Christmas break, I got a really good amount of progress done on my 2GS game that I've been plugging away at.
Nice.
So it's very close to release.
So did you just get in a plane and fly around for a while?
Yeah, almost. I had a lot of time to kill at my sister's because they were busy. So I brought my laptop and knowing that I was going to have this time. And I just spent a good couple of days solid working on it. And so I'm just in bug fixing mode now. It's playable. It's basically done. It's not tuned or fun, but it probably never will be. it's going to get released somewhere between like beta and abandoned, just because I want to just get it done so I can do other sure. things that I want to do. I have other retro projects that I want to do, and I don't let myself start something new until I finish the current thing. Otherwise, I never finish anything. So, yeah. So I've been stubbornly not starting any of the cooler things that I want to do for 7 years while I finish this thing. And, this one of us is going to die, at the end of this, and, it's going to have to be it. So I'm going to release it, and it is what it is.
It's not released so much as you were paroled.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's getting kicked out of the door, and it needs to go get a job, frankly, cause it's old enough to drive this project. Yeah, it's no technical tour de force or anything. It was just my, like, I want to write a 2GS game because I had never done it, and I always wanted to be able to do it. So,
sure.
So that'll get released hopefully within the next, I don't know, couple of months is my goal, just to have that released. It'll go out on the Slack. So part of that is this retro room downstairs. I have to get it tested on real hardware. This thing has never run on real hardware, except...
With the 2GS, that's
really
important.
A big deal. Yeah, I mean, I take that back. It ran for 10 minutes on John Brooks's 2GS at K-Fest like 4 years ago, and I found out, that's where I found out how badly all the emulators are.
emulators are terrible.
Yeah, all the vertical blank emulation is all terrible. So, I had a vertical blank timing that I thought was... plenty of cushion on all three emulators. I thought, you know, I'm getting enough done. I'm keeping my frame rate. And then on real hardware, it was like, you're not even close. Like, it was like, who do you think you are? So, that's where I gave up on 60 FPS when I realized how far out it was on real hardware. It's like, well, I'll just abandon that goal. Long story short, I hope to have that out soon. And I want to give a shout out to the 2GS Slack, which has been super awesome for technical help on this game. And also a fellow Apple II enthusiast actually sent me a keyboard and mouse because mine got lost in the move or in somewhere along the way in the last 20 years. I thought it was in my dad's basement, and it wasn't. My 2GS was down there, and there was no keyboard and no mouse. Which really broke my heart because I wanted my original. I think what happened was when moved on from the 2GS to the Mac, I took my 2GS keyboard and mouse.
Keyboard because it's such a good keyboard.
Yeah, because it's still ADB, and the 2GS keyboard is the best Mac keyboard best you can keyboard. Buy. So I took it with me, and then traveled around the world with that Mac as my primary daily driver computer. And then at some point, I got rid of that Mac. I don't even know what happened to the Mac, and the keyboard and mouse went with it. I guess whatever I did with it. And they were gone forever. But anyway.
2GS keyboard is the reason why I always think in every other keyboard, the caps lock key is in the wrong place.
Yes, totally.
No, you don't use it that often. Put it down the corner. That's how the best keyboard did it.
Yeah, and the best key switches. And it was the only keyboard that's actually only as big as keyboards need to be. There's like a 1/16 of an inch of plastic around the keys. There should never be more than that. Why keyboards are so unnecessarily large drives me crazy. The 2GS keyboard is the best keyboard Apple ever made, I think. That's all happening.
At her, nerds.
Oh, I've made so many enemies in this episode alone. But everybody's so drunk from Blake that nobody's going to remember any of this. I think I'm in the clear.
No doubt.
So that's it for me.
By the way, R2 in the chat mentions for the like SD card or like solid state C64, the SD2 IEC, and that's the one that I had heard of too. I'm sure I have one somewhere waiting to do something with.
I see.
And also, someone else mentions, I remember Einstein says 1541 Ultimate is my preferred SD card.
I have heard of that one. I think that's
Rob with that one.
Yeah, Rob O'Hara, I think, recommends that one as well, the 1541.
It might be sacrilege, but is there a flavor of Fujinet for the Commodore yet?
Probably.
Because there's one for a lot of different systems, I think.
That might be a good option, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Does Fujinet have internal storage? Maybe it does. I thought it was just mostly a network thing, but maybe it does have an SD card.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Not yet.
Apparently, the chat. R2's not yet.
But I'm excited to get my GS up and running to test my game because that machine, so that GS has not booted in 25 years.
Really?
And one of the things that was in the box that I got from my dad was my original hard drive. It's an external SCSI hard drive. And so all of my junior high and high school projects are all on that hard drive.
That'll be fun to look at.
I really hope the drive's okay and it boots. It'll be really exciting if it does because I... who, Lord only knows what all is on that hard drive. It's 40.
Right, which I'm sure you'll find like weird and embarrassing or whatever, but that's totally worth getting and preserving and backing up. And like that's
cool. 40 megabytes of memories on there for sure. It's my entire childhood is on that thing. And speaking of things you didn't know you had, in that box was also my, I found my notes. I found two binders full of notes from my junior high and high school game development efforts. So like all of my little sprite drawings and math calculations, figuring stuff out, it's all in there. So, I mean, I'm not Jordan Mechner, so no one's ever going to care about that stuff, but it was fun to find it.
But still, you can do a collab with yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'll do a Steam thing where I go through all those notes or something. I don't know. No, no one's ever going to care. But yeah, it was, yeah, it's neat to find them. They're less impressive than I remembered. You're never as smart as you thought you were back in the day, I think. But, anyway, I think that's it for my retro stuff.
Cool. All right. Is it dancing time?
I think it must be. Yes. So that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can find lo-fi episodes and more via Gopher at rcrpodcast.com. You should watch the stream if you have a chance.
just
for the dancing at the end, yes. You can discuss the show in the forums at forum.vcfed.org somewhere. You can follow RCR on Mastodon. We are podcasts.social at rcrpodcast. Join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcasts. Send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network. I'm not doing this very rhythmically, so I'm making the dancing very difficult. But we're a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. Please write a review on iTunes if you want. And until next time...
Retro Compute!